Beyond Fest. We are Shockwaves.
We are half of Shockwaves.
Two fourths.
Rebecca McKendry, our co-host, is off shooting a movie. We're very proud of her for that. And Elric Kane is...
We're not sure. In New York, apparently.
Probably with Michael Ironside running through a field of roses.
Yeah. If but you guys we're excited to be here for you. So.
Yeah, we're very excited.
Because we got a kick-ass guest.
We do. We do. If you guys don't know who we are, Shockwaves is a podcast you can find on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify. It is Rob, me, Elric, Becca. Rob and Elric and Becca did a great job with a podcast called Killer POV. I used to do one called The Bloodcast, and then when we all hopped over to Blumhouse, we just joined forces for this cool podcast now.
Voltron style.
Yeah. Let's bring out our guest.
Yeah.
Nick Castle.
The Shape.
The Shape itself.
Thank you, Nick. So cool to see you.
Good to see you again.
Thank you.
And before anything, on behalf of everybody in the audience, I'd like to thank you for The Last Starfighter and The Boy Who Could Fly. He directed those films. On top of being The Shape, fine director.
Thank you, appreciate it.
Major Payne. Can't forget
Come
that
on,
one
more,
either.
More.
No. Mr. Wrong?
Well, see? that did kill my career, so thank you for mentioning that.
Rob, you wanted to kick off.
Yeah, you know what? I wanted to start with the new movie, because if you didn't know, Nick is back as The Shape in the movie that you're about to see, which is really exciting. But... What's cool about this is I was kind of tracking you on Twitter while this movie was happening, and you had tweeted a photo of just your silhouette. And the second I saw it, I was like, holy shit, that's Michael Myers. Like, you just knew it right away. Is there any reason that they had never asked you to reprise The Shape in any of the other movies? Or was this the first time that somebody thought, we should get Nick Castle back?
No, it's definitely the first time. You know, I'm not an actor by trade, and also this was the first movie in '78 that I think you all just saw, right?
Yes.
Was something I did because a friend of mine was directing it, and then I went on to do my own movies as a writer and director, and never looked back in terms of acting again. So, no, this happened because my good pal and agent for. Conventions, Sean Clark was talking to some folks. I think this was how it happened, at least that, and they were looking for the next Michael Myers for the new movie. And Sean just said, "Well, what about Nick?" And they went, "Well, as if maybe he wouldn't want to do it." And I just thought it would be a hoot. So eventually, I talked to David, and I'm sure you know by now. Hopefully, most of you know at least this is, you know, I am in the new movie, but in a limited capacity. Almost all the work is done by James Courtney, who does, from what I have seen so far, a fantastic job. I think you'll all be very happy in a few minutes.
Can you tell the audience the video that you sent, David? when you were like, yeah, let's do it.
Yes, I can do that. That's funny. You know, so we were talking at the moment I found out about this. I didn't know how much I was going to do. I wasn't sure. I was pretty sure I didn't want to be on set for the whole time, you know, and things like that. You know, I'm 71 years old. You needed someone that's going to take a punch. You know, that wasn't me. But I did want to reassure David after we spoke through Skype, you know, to each other, that I was available and willing and able to do it. So I went on my treadmill, put on the mask, and showed in a video clip that I could actually still walk. So I sent that to David. And that's what
he came with, "I'm getting in shape." I think that was the caption. I think it was.
Had to do it. Had to do it.
That's we'll have to retweet that one or find it again because it is pretty wonderful.
It is awesome. And we were sitting in the production office when you sent that, and I just saw the look on David's face because he was looking at his computer, and David's got this very like kind of concerned look on his face, and he's concentrating, and then he just grinned, this giant grin. He's like, guys, you got to see this. And we all had a blast with it. So.
Nothing warmed my heart more than seeing a photo from set of Ryan with John Carpenter and you, just the three of you guys in the middle of the shoot. I know this is probably a hard question to answer, but what was it like for you to kind of be in the middle of this thing? I mean, you made the first movie with friends 40 years ago, and here you are. Is it kind of deja vu, or how did it feel to be there?
Oh, yeah, it did feel like deja vu. I mean, it. Well, you know, deja vu 40 years later, it's a very unique experience. You know, you the idea that this movie, at the when we shot it, would have this kind of fan base and this much fun, and that it would generate all this excitement, and then this 40 years later one, which was when I read the script, I realized that they're really doing it right. And talking to David and talking to Danny and the group, I knew they were going to come up with something special. So I was very happy to be a part of it. And when I first got on set, Jamie was already there and spotted me across the set and ran up to me and hugged me and said, "Is this nuts or what?" And so that's how we felt. You know, it was just very crazy, as you might imagine, doing something that long ago.
Wow. Let's go back to the beginning, to the original movie.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you guys know this, but The Ringer has a new podcast out called Halloween Unmasked, and I highly suggest you listen to the first two episodes. He got really excited. I know. The first two episodes are fantastic, but what was great was a John anecdote talking about the first time he met Tommy Lee Wallace. And I think it was like, he was like, "That guy was a jerk. I thought he was a jerk." And Amy was like, "Why do you think that?" He's like, "I don't know. We just always thought, you know, the new guy was a jerk." So I'm curious, the first time you met John, how did you guys get along right away? What was the vibe?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we met in film school. You know, we both went to the University of Southern California down the road, cinema department back in the late 60s. Someone else? Yeah. and in fact, John and I, you know, went back to the film department 2 weeks ago and showed the 4K version of 78. And we realized as we were sitting there that it was 50 years ago, you know, this year that we had started in the film department. So that was crazy. Now going back another 10 years. So yes, I knew John. I don't remember anything specific or any great, wonderful story about meeting him. I just knew he was one of the most talented people in the class. You could tell right from his 241, 290 movies, as we called them then, 8mm with no sound, you know, that he had something special. And of course, as it turns out, he's been probably working on films already for 5 or 6 years, you know, in his back in Kentucky. So the other thing that we had in common very quickly we found out was music. We both loved rock and roll. We both were in bands. We both sang. We both played guitar and piano. And so we would get together, and we eventually formed a kind of vanity group called the Coupe de Villes that would do music for films on campus and then eventually off.
Oh, we'll get to the Coupe de Villes. what came first, Coupe de Villes or Halloween? You already had started the band by the time you made this movie?
Let's see. Oh, yes, we had the Coupe de Villes before this. You know, we had done, in fact, some of the music in Halloween was done previous to Halloween, and I'm not even sure, I can't remember specifically why it was even recorded, let alone good enough to be in the movie, but we eventually used it.
That was the doo-wop song, a little doo-wop song that was in the car.
Yeah.
If you guys own the Big Trouble in Little China Blu-ray, go and watch the Coupe de Villes video right away. It is amazing.
And Nick, for you, I mean, when you were in school, were you a genre fan as much as John was? What creatively, where were you coming from? What did you want to do? I mean, was the goal always writer-director?
The goal was to get a girlfriend that was really attractive.
In film school.
In film school, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it was, well, No, you know, I come from a family where my father was a filmmaker, not a filmmaker, but worked in film and in TV. He was a choreographer. He was a dance director. And I was always in the back, would be in the background. I was in a couple of movies, as a matter of fact, when I was a little kid, 6 and 7 years old, in a Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis movie called Artist and Models. And, you know, so I had as a background musicals. That really was part of what I thought I would be getting into. Movies with music. I thought I'd be the next Vincent Minnelli. It turns out I wasn't. But no. So in terms of genre, I learned the genres actually going to USC, which was a great experience in terms of the kind of retrospectives they would do on all kinds of different genres, westerns and film noirs and things like that.
Was there anything specific that John recommended to you?
Well, no, you know, we were such on a par with each other. I don't remember. I remember us just going to these movies, you know, and you would actually have people like John Ford walk into the cinema department and have a discussion over a film we're watching. So it was a tremendous time, you know, and a real great opportunity to meet, you know, some of your heroes.
I want to ask a little bit about seeing the original movie for the first time, because up until the Blair Witch Project, Halloween was the most financially successful independent film ever. And so this thing was huge, but you were making a movie with your friends and you're playing the shape in it. It terrified everybody when it came out, but I'm curious, being there behind the scenes, did it work for you? Were you able to see Halloween objectively and understand why it was connecting with people?
Oh, not until I was in a real movie theater. You know, I don't recall. In fact, my memory, now again, this is 40 years ago, my memory of seeing the movie the first time was on Hollywood Boulevard, not this theater, but there's one down the street. I forget which one it was. It may not even be functioning anymore. But I just sat in an audience just to see how it was playing. It was the first week it was out, and people were just going crazy. And I remember calling John and said, "John, it's working." You know, and of course, you know, it took a while. I think if you know the lore about this, you know, it wasn't well received by the critics. You know, it wasn't didn't have a fantastic opening, as I can recall. But then it started to get some buzz. Roger Ebert gave it a good review, and people started to look at it again from the standpoint of, hey, this is a real filmmaker making this, and this is a real movie that's fucking scary. So put the two together, it could be something special, and then it worked. But as far as what your specific question is, I only could understand it when I saw it with an audience. Tommy Wallace, who was the editor and John's best pal from Kentucky, and played the shape in a couple of scenes too in the 78 version. He tells the story about seeing the first cut without music and them going, "Hmm." And then putting the music on and went, "Whoa, it works." That's interesting. You see how important that score is, which is unbelievable. And I am so, you know, John's, you must, you know, you think about it. If your pal writes a score and AFI calls it one of the 50 best scores in the history of cinema, American cinema, I mean, that's pretty cool, you know. That is pretty damn cool, and I'm so proud of John for doing that. And, of course, his career is fantastic.
Can you just talk about the overall atmosphere on set, you know, between all these personalities, John and Deborah and Jamie, yourself, Tommy? Just, I mean, like, I think there's a kind of a romanticized version of what it was like, you know, all fun and games, but I'm sure that there were, you know, a lot of challenges as well.
Well, it was a very professional group, even though they were, you know, relatively young. You know, most of the people on the crew were early 30s, and so it felt like an evolution from film school. It did feel like that, but it also felt like the people that were there were the best students. You know, they were really sharp. That they understood the work and they took it seriously. And of course, I don't know, whatever. Do you know the amount of days? It was like 20 days or 20, a couple.
I think it's like 21 or something.
21 days. I mean, you got to be prepared. You can't screw around. There was none of that. But one of the lessons I learned from John, and one of the reasons I went on the set itself, was to, which John was gracious enough to let me be on the set. That's why he said, "Why don't you put on the mask and walk around?" and he said, it was fun to see how he would deal with human beings, you know, have fun with it, take take suggestions and create an atmosphere that was, good. So, you know, it is kind of a fairy tale in the sense that I can't think of a bad moment. There's not like a clunker guy that was on the thing we had to throw out or, you know, the worst thing that ever happened on the set was, you know, me feeling almost getting killed when John said, turn on the water. And I was outside in a gown being the shape before he gets his mask. And that just in 40 degree weather in Los Angeles in the whatever that was, the winter. And that's the only thing I can, you know, I could see as the downside of the first Halloween.
Can you talk about your any fond memories of Deborah Hill?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, first of all, it's just, we lost her too early. You know, Deborah was the producer, a co-writer. And, you know, even if you listen to Jamie, especially, who knew, you know, had the relationship there, it was so instrumental in helping, you know, in creating the bond between the girls in the movie, you know, having that. And I really love what John and Deborah did with that part of it, to let those characters come alive, have the fun that they have, find clever, you know, lines that they can say and repeat. She was very instrumental in bringing that to the thing. But also, you know, she came from the crew. She was she started off as a script supervisor, and when you're in that position, you really, really understand a shoot. You understand it from all kinds of different ways. And that's it's a very good stepping stone to producing. And she took that transition really well. She's a wonderful person, very, very smart, and a big rooter for the projects. You know, you really want a producer to be behind you as a director, too. And of course, they were romantically involved at the time, too, so that didn't hurt.
Do you want to talk about the Coupe de Villes?
No. Just check out the Coupe de Villes if you can. Although I'd love a reunion since John's touring these days, but who knows? Maybe one of these days we can poke him about that.
Well, you know, John's going to be at the Palladium here on
that's
Halloween.
That's right, Halloween night.
Yeah. If you haven't got your tickets or if it hasn't been sold out, I mean, it's a great show. And I haven't seen this iteration of it, but, you know, it's going to be very similar, I think, but new materials.
Yeah,
but
a few new things, a few new twists.
Yeah.
Well, according to the folklore, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, on the original movie, when you'd go to John and ask him, all right, what do you want me to do as the shape? He would just say, just walk, man. Like, there is no direction other than just walk however you walk. How about, what was David Gordon Green's direction? And what are the similarities and differences between the two? Because I think they're both really, really interesting filmmakers. And I consider them both kind of auteurs.
Yeah, I mean, I really was impressed with David, you know, not knowing him at all and having these few conversations. He was so sweet, by the way. He sent me the script, you know. He wanted to let me know, you know, what I was up up against or what it was, which I thought was really wonderful. And I had a couple ideas. So he said, you know, this is, and he appreciated it. I didn't, you know, you don't want to step on toes there. You're coming back, the old man, and 40 years later, telling the young kid what to do. But thankfully, he took it for what it was worth, and I think I found that to be really, really great. As far as John is concerned, John, you know, for me, you know, this was John was the puppet master, not the movie, but the real puppet master in this thing, you know, not being an actor, you know, I didn't have, you know, I didn't have any of the background to consider how I would start to prepare for the movie. All I knew was I was putting on a mask and walking left to right. And John basically, his direction was very similar. I remember the first scene I was in. I do remember that because that was my concern. I was walking to the point where he said to start, and I stopped. And when I came back, and I said, John, this is the first shot. The shape. What is this? What's the whole? What do you want? I'm going to walk. He said, just get over there and walk. You know, we're old buddies. He's just like, he didn't, you know, he had to do 15 other things. So he probably saw me and thought that was fine, and that's the way it's going to go. And since then, John has, I think, embellished it to be more of like, you know, I really like the way he walked. He looked like a serial killer. Yes? Well, maybe. You never know. And as far as David is concerned, you know, it's like I said, a limited time with him as the actor, as the shape. But It was interesting. I there were so many similarities between his crew, what I just talked about in terms of the way that the crew functioned in Charleston and the way it functioned 40 years earlier in Los Angeles and Pasadena was very similar. You had the feeling, and part of it is true, that David brought his film people, from his film school, his guys that he can trust to do a film that had to be done on a budget. This thing you're going to see is the equivalent in a way to what John had to do back in the day. You know, yes, it's more money, but you have to be prepared. You have to be and oh my God, David, and his temperament, by the way, is fantastic too. Very similar to John's too. It's not the tall, quiet type, but the quiet type. You know, and he. I think he did the same thing. Put together a crew and a mood that helped get the best out of everybody.
What was your dialogue like with Jim, who plays our new Myers? You know, I saw you guys buddying. You know, you guys got along really well, really fast, and I saw you guys kind of buddying up in the makeup trailer quite a bit. Just talk about the dialogue between you. Did he ask a lot of questions about how you played the shape?
You know, by the time I got there, it had already been, I think, 2 weeks into production. So Jim had already taken off. You know, what he had set to do was kind of, you know, framed already. But he did tell me that he looked at the movie, he kind of felt like he was inspired by the character and then took it in his own direction. You know, when our conversations while we were in the makeup trailer together or fooling around was literally that, fooling around, having a lot of fun. He's a great guy, and no, he's like 6'3", so you got to watch out for this guy. He's a tough guy, you know. And I was thinking, like, how would I describe the difference between this guy in the 78 and this guy now? Besides the fact that he's obviously 40 years older, is that David, I remember talked to Jim. I was told said that he looked at this character's cat-like. And that gives a kind of impression. Well, I remembered thinking that I felt like I was a panther. And when I look at Jim, because he's more sturdy, I thought he's more like a lion. But both in that same wheelhouse, you know. I mean, he's a strong-ass guy. And he does, you'll see. You'll like it.
Yeah. Let's open it up to questions from the audience. Anybody have a, yeah, right here.
Asking about the choreography in the original film and a lot of the sequences where you pop out, if that's kind of improvised.
Yeah, no, nothing is improvised. That's all done by the click, almost, you know, the metronome, you know, come out now. You know, it's, and you can tell it is, you know, it's like, I think, I don't know if it was David or John talking about this, but because they were talking about, I mean, probably David, because they're talking about comedy, doing so much comedy and doing this thing. And he said, timing is still the factor. You know, timing on a good joke still has to be at a certain beat. Timing when you jump out of it has to be on the same right beat, or else you lose it. You know, if you don't have and that's what I thought David kind of learned or maybe knew instinctively about doing horror, is that when you look at John's movie, this movie here, there's a lot of quiet time. There's a lot of time for you to wait for this horrible thing to happen. That's part of what you need to know about in order to create a horror movie that works.
Right there. Talk about co-writing Escape from New York.
Hells yeah.
Oh, thank you. Up there.
Escape from New York, come on.
Well, this is another reason why you always stay friends with your film school buddies when you want to become a filmmaker. Because, again, John was the first one out of the gate, out of our group of filmmakers at USC, and started doing movies. And he did two really good ones, Dark Star and Assault on Precinct 13. Wonderful movies, both of them. I worked on Dark Star in the background, as we all did when we were doing our student films, because it started as a student film. And so when John got... he did a couple movies, and he did Halloween. I think he even did The Fog, right? Before that, and he said he was wiped out. And we were talking one day, and he said, "You know what? I really could use you to help me with this next project. I'm fried, And I just pulled out from the trunk, the old trunk that you pull out when you get out of film school and start writing scripts, you know, pulled out Escape from New York. He had written it as his first movie ever, his first screenplay, rather. And he put it in the trunk. It didn't work yet. And so he showed it to whatever it was, AFCO Embassy. They said, whoa, this is a cool idea. And he said, okay, well, let me figure this out. So John said, work with me on this thing. And we went from page one to the end and did changes in this. But the conceit of the movie was there, you know, and the plot line in general was there. And what we did was create new characters, new situations, and new ending, and, you know, lots of different things, and had a ball doing it.
What was the one major I mean, I'm really curious to know what that first draft was like.
Yeah, it's hard.
Was there even a snake?
Oh, there was definitely a snake, Plissken. I know there was a, you know, a big opening sequence that actually was wound up being filmed but cut, I think. There was no taxi driver. There was no Ernest Borgnine character. There was no fight in the ring. Yeah. You know, what I was bringing to it was, which was not necessarily as I remember, was all the New York, all the New York icons, and making sure that we hit them in a way that was both fun and not overly obvious, maybe. And the ending wasn't there where the most cynical ending in the history of motion pictures. He's saving the world, supposedly, and Snake just decides, ah, fuck it, I'll destroy this thing. So, things like that.
Any other question right up there? Yes, sir, with your hand waving.
Anything specific that informed you working with John early on as a director?
Yeah, and I've kind of mentioned it, one of them, which is your comportment, how to become someone that gets enough stuff out of the crew and cast that you've employed, and how to make the set something that is fun to come to every day. It sounds like it's easy, but it's not necessarily easy, because you're under such stress all the time as a director. And you've all heard the stories of people that do go off, you know, crazy, and they can still do great work. But frankly, you know, a big part of your life, if you're lucky, is making films. They take a long time and you're working with people. Why not have a good time? You know, that's important. But besides that, I think, the things that I remember asking John were things like, you know, how are you working on with the camera? What is your, you know, what is your theory about that, if anything? And he actually gave me some of these. He says, well, you know what? Every shot can be special. And even if you just move the camera a little bit. Now, this is before, this is right as Panaglide is coming in. You saw how he worked with that. But, and he also, this is influence from film school, actually. Looking back at the classic movies of Hollywood, and not being so enamored with the new wave that was going then, which was, you know, was breaking boundaries in terms of the way that stylistically, and he felt, and a lot of the students there felt, to go back and to see what was what made those films so classic, so important, that they stand the test of time. And I thought that was a good lesson, and that certainly was part of his legacy to me.
Got time for one more. Anybody else? Anyone? Right there, right in the middle. How has fan culture affected your life?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I mean, as I mentioned, I have an agent for doing these horror cons and fan cons that I resisted for many years. I didn't know what to make of it, because I thought maybe I was, if I would go, was I elongating a bad habit that people get into, you know, or during these things? And I just didn't understand it per se. Once I relented and went for the first time, I absolutely loved it. Not because you're getting patted on the back, you know, which is nice, you know. but also because I realized these films that you make have an effect on people, and they enjoy it. And you know, as a filmmaker, rather maybe more so than someone that does plays where you can get an immediate reaction from, you don't see the audience. You never do, you know, unless you something like this or at these things. So it's really you know, after years and years of doing this, to find out that people were affected by the movie, that were happy to have the movie, that it's, you know, it's a great feeling to feel like your life wasn't completely no. So in any case, yes. Well, thank you for the question, because I think it is important, and I really appreciate the fans when they stop and say hello.
Yeah, and if you didn't know, October 12th through the 14th, there's going to be a huge Halloween 40th anniversary convention in Pasadena with this guy and everybody from the whole franchise. So that's going to be a blast.
Yeah, it's the H4O convention. What's the website, Sean? Clark?
He disappeared.
All right, look up the H40 convention. Just Google it. You'll find it. Tickets are available.
Yeah, it's all going to be there.
Shockwaves will be live there.
Nick's going to be there.
Nick's going to be there. There'll be a Halloween 2018 panel. It's going to be awesome.
And to wrap up, you know, as a co-host with Ryan on Shockwaves, I see him every week. We've been friends for over a decade. I haven't seen this yet. Nick hasn't seen this yet. I'm really proud of him that he's a producer on this movie, and I think it's fucking cool because he's one of us, and one of us got to make a new Halloween movie, and it's fucking rad. So congrats.
Thanks, buddy. Thank you. I think with that, we should just show you the movie.
Yeah.
We've waited long enough. Nick, thank you so much for coming on, buddy.